Tony Clark was the author of Blue Gold with Maud Barlow. He's back out now with a new book called Tar Sands Showdown, and he was in Hamilton recently giving a lecture on that book. Today we present Tony Clark, Tar Sands Showdown.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
A bit of pleasure, if you will. And Tony is going to be addressing the notion. We're delighted to have him here tonight. Join me in welcoming Tony Clark to Hamilton.
Thank you, Brian, very much for that introduction, and thank you all for coming out tonight. But thank you very much for coming out tonight to this Red Valley Hill lecture. And keeping in mind the spirit of Red Valley Hill and what it stands for and what the people who originally fought in that battle stood for. So it's a great honor to be here this evening and to be a part of this whole process. I want to thank people like Don McLean and Joanna Chapman who have kept me on the straight and narrow for the last few weeks because there's been no question that there's been a real concern to make sure I get here and to be a part of everything that's going on. So I'm here, happy to be here, and looking forward to this evening and our discussion. I wonder how many of you have actually been to the tar sands in Alberta, or the oil sands if you prefer that name. Anybody been there? Ah, 5, 6, 7, 8. My goodness, great. I think you will agree with me, those that have been there, that it is quite a marvel to see what is happening there in one sense because of the incredible technological developments that are taking place, but on the other hand, the unbelievable destruction that is also going on simultaneously as far as the environment and socially itself. Now, this is something that the Alberta tar sands is not something that just came into being overnight. It's important to remember that the history probably goes back a century now, and certainly when we talk about the last 50 years, it's been in the last 50 years that the gradual development of the tar sands has taken place and taken hold. And today it is the largest capital intensive energy development to be found anywhere in the world, something like between $150 to $200 billion of investment is planned over the next 15 or 20 years in the tar sands alone. Now, I want you to think for a moment in terms of our own history as a country. We have had these sudden historical bursts of industrial development throughout our history. The building of the CPR, which is magically understood as our national dream, but certainly was a huge mega project of its kind in those days, in the 80s, and giving rise to the railway that stretched across the country. There have been other major moments in our development, such as the building up of the industrial infrastructure that took place around World War II. There's also been the whole story of the big hydro projects like the James Bay Hydro development. And there's been the building of the manufacturing base in both, particularly here in Ontario and southwestern Ontario, and to some extent in parts of Quebec as well. There have been moments in our history where there have been these historical breakthroughs in terms of industrial development that have in a sense become the center of the economy itself at a certain point in time. Well, today, the Alberta tar sands is one of those historical breakthroughs. It is a mega energy corridor, and for that very reason, within 2 or 3 weeks after Stephen Harper became Prime Minister in January of 2006, he was off to the United Kingdom spouting the fact that, in his view anyway, that Canada would be the next energy superpower of the world. He based his pronouncements on the Alberta tar sands. And he equated the Alberta tar sands with the Great Wall of China, or the building of the Great Wall of China, and the Egyptian pyramids.
One of the primary targets for British investors has been our booming energy sector. They have recognized, you have recognized, the emergence of Canada's global energy powerhouse, or, as we put it, the emerging energy superpower our government intends to build. Now, this is no exaggeration. We are currently the fifth largest energy producer in the world. We rank third and seventh in global gas and oil production, respectively. We generate more hydroelectricity than any other country on Earth, and we are the world's largest supplier of uranium. But that's just the beginning. Our government is making new investments in renewable energy sources such as biofuels, and an ocean of oil-soaked sand lies under the Muskeg of northern Alberta, my home province. The oil sands are the second largest oil deposit in the world, bigger than Iraq, Iran, or Russia, exceeded only by Saudi Arabia. Digging the bitumen out of the ground, squeezing the oil and converting it into synthetic crude is a monumental challenge. It requires vast amounts of capital, Brobdingnagian technology, and an array of skilled workers. In short, it is an enterprise of epic proportions, akin to building the pyramids or China's Great Wall, only bigger. By 2015, Canadian oil production is forecast to reach almost 4 million barrels a day. Two-thirds of it will come from the oil sands. Even now, Canada is the only non-OPEC country in the world with growing oil deliverability.
In other words, he too has a certain sense of fantasy and a certain sense of vision with regards to how something like the Alberta tar sands can become the centerpiece in one's understanding of history, in one's understanding of the country that he is leading at this point in time. So I say to you today, it's important that we grasp the fact that all the forces have been pointing in the direction of the Alberta tar sands becoming that center of our history, the center of our economy, the center of our politics. And as for that very reason, the Alberta tar sands is shaping our destiny as a people and as a nation, at least for the first quarter of the 21st century. So I think it's very important that we look at the tar sands as a concern, a national concern, and not just an Alberta concern. All too often up to this point, partly because of the sensitivities surrounding the National Energy Program of the 1980s, everybody has been sort of saying, well, that's Alberta's big baby, and we will just step aside and let it happen. Well, folks, it is not Alberta's baby alone. It is now front and center in our own destiny and history as a country. And so we better come to grips with its implications and understand what it means for this point in time and where we go as we head into the early stages of this 21st century. We are in a defining moment, a moment in which the tar sands mega machine is actually, in my view, triggering several crises, what I call the triple E crises. And this is the crises of the economy, the crises of the environment, and the crises of energy itself. And it's those kinds of matters that I would like to turn our attention to and discuss here this evening. So what I would like to do is speak in terms of five different segments of the tar sands. The first is the tar sands industry itself. Then look secondly at the economic crisis that we are experiencing, and particularly here in Hamilton. Thirdly, to look at the environmental crisis that the tar sands has been triggering. Fourthly, look at the energy crisis that it's wrapped up in and a part of. And finally, say something about the politics or the new petrol politics. So those are the five segments which I would like to briefly address and speak to. As far as the tar sands industry is concerned, It goes back, as I said, almost a century. And back in 1951, there was the first big oil sands conference that was called by Premier Ernest Manning back in 1951. It was from that point on that the building and development of the private sector in taking over the tar sands began to take hold in the country itself. And it became started to build as a huge industry. But it was not just an industry that simply picked up and bought up land and that was it. It was part of a whole process that had gone on beforehand, having to do with Treaties 8 and Treaties 11 in that part of the country. Treaty 8 in particular was the area that covered the Athabasca, and Treaty 8 has turned out since then to be understood and historically proven to be a fraudulent treaty in the sense that signatures were forged and the First Nations found themselves giving up their land. They saw this as peace and friendship treaties, but in the end, it meant giving up their land and surrendering their land. But because those treaties were considered to be fraudulent, there is a great deal of historical debate about all of that and what the implications really are. If we look seriously at what is happening, has happened since then, the federal government moved in, took over parts of the land, the provincial government took over other parts. There was a battle between the federal and provincial governments over control of the land, and then the industry moved in and took over from that squabble. We then move on to recognize that the Athabasca tar sands itself has a huge geological deposit of bitumen. And bitumen is a very tar-like substance, very much like the tar on roads. But in it, of course, is contained oil. And the whole objective was to try to separate the oil from the bitumen. When you look at the geological deposits of the tar sands right now, in the area that's covered by this map up here, you will find that in that area, up to as high as 2.5 trillion barrels of oil are potentially there. But only 175 billion to 200 billion of that is really recoverable with current technologies, and maybe as much as 315 billion barrels eventually with new technologies. Right now, the technologies that are used are strip mining and the in situ process, which means that for the deeper deposits, it means taking steam and shooting steam down and heating the bitumen so that it becomes more liquidy and can be therefore brought to the surface. So both strip mining and in situ processes are the technologies that are used for this. We're talking about a highly resource-intensive development using a great deal of natural gas, which is, as you know, a relatively clean fossil fuel, to transform and make a dirty fuel, which is what exactly the tar sands crude is. It's a dirty fuel. And many people have likened this to very much like putting gold into lead as process. At the same time, it also uses a great deal of fresh water, and as a result ends up sucking a great deal of water and contaminating a great deal of water that is in one of the most precious watersheds to be found in the world today. When we look at the production that is planned by the industry between now, 2008, through 2015 and up to 2020, we find that there are major developments being planned and major projects underway. All of the ones that I've identified up there have gone through the first and in some cases the second and third stages of approval. You can see that that in many cases these projects, when you put them all together and add them all up, they're well over 5 million barrels a day that will be produced from the tar sands itself. Now, of course, the current economic downturn is putting a damper on this for the time being, but there is no question that these industries that are up there, the ones that are identified there, are firmly committed to development of the tar sands itself. And so these production plans are very much a part of the wave of the future as well as the present. The pipelines that you see from this National Energy Board map show the existing pipeline structure that brings the regular conventional oil from Alberta and tar sands crude oil down to southern markets. And you can see how the whole system is lined up to deliver to U.S. markets and to make that a big part of the future. There are new pipelines that are not in there in that map, but in a subsequent map that we'll show a little bit later, you'll see new pipelines such as the Gateway Pipeline that goes across to the West Coast, British Columbia, or the Keystone Pipeline that moves down and links with all sorts of pipeline systems down to the Gulf Coast and into the central western part of the United States. And finally, the companies that are involved, the two big ones that were to begin with, Syncrude and Suncor, but on top of that, you have the three big U.S. majors, which are ExxonMobil, Conoco, Phillips, and Chevron Texaco, have a big stake in the tar sands, and then two international giants, namely Shell Oil and British Petroleum. So you can see that there are big players with big investments that are a part of this agenda. Now, it's important for us to take another look at the tar sands and to understand that the industry itself has also been part of triggering an economic crisis. And this is the economic crisis that we have been experiencing, and you in particular here in southwestern Ontario have been experiencing, the job losses, the market crash that has occurred. And what we're going to talk about very briefly is the way in which the tar sands has contributed to that economic crisis, at least in playing a role to trigger it in the first place. As we said before, the tar sands boom itself is really the product of the pushing of the tar sands into the actual center of our economy, making this the big centerpiece of the Canadian development agenda. And looking first of all from the standpoint that the tar sands represents or allows us to be seen in the eyes of at least our current prime minister as the new energy superpower in the world. And at the same time, though, it has also produced an overheated Alberta economy that has spilled into other parts and other economies across the country and has certainly had a huge impact on what has happened here in southwestern Ontario. And the reason for this is that what has happened is that our currency on currency markets has really become a petrodollar. We're talking about a currency that is driven by oil prices. And as we all know, that's what's been happening over the last few years leading up to a few months ago. And that is that oil prices rose and soared. As those oil prices soared, so did our currency rate and so did the Canadian dollar. So the loonie took flight as a result of rising and soaring oil prices themselves. And this flying loonie, in turn, had a major impact, as we know, on manufacturing the exports. Our exports were no longer competitive because of the high value of the Canadian dollar. And to sell those products into an American market made it all the more difficult. And so we found ourselves in a situation where we weren't able to sell those products to the same volume and same degree as before, and we end up having a depressed manufacturing base, job losses all over the place, and all of that occurring in the last several years leading up to the last couple of months. And so what we found, therefore, was as the U.S. recession set in, and even though there's been a dampening on the oil prices and a dampening on the Canadian dollar, the U.S. recession meant that the export market really wasn't there, and the demand really wasn't there to be able to buy our products. Now, this isn't just something that's cyclical. It's come, and it's going to go away again and come back again. I'm afraid that the problem that we're faced with in Canada today is that we have a serious, serious distortion in our economy, and it's a structural distortion. The problem is that we have lost the vision of building an industrial and manufacturing base, and we have allowed resources and commodities to take over and to dominate the Canadian economy. And with that happening, so have we seen the rising of an up and down of the Canadian dollar, which is having wreaking real havoc in terms of our jobs and our situation in the country as a whole in the economy. The economic recession in the U.S. has meant that there is a depressed demand and that our exports in manufacturing are stagnating. But this, as I said, is a structural problem that has got to be addressed. And anybody watching the election debates must have come to the conclusion that very little was said about that, very little analysis was done by the party leaders on that, and it's therefore a part of the real challenge that lies ahead is to really take this on and to show that the tar sands boom and the resource sector in general has been leading the Canadian economy in such a way that we are seriously losing our manufacturing base in this country. One of the things I think we need to recognize too, however, is that this is not something that has just happened, I said, by happenstance, as I said before. It's something that has truly built up, largely because of the way in which the people in Ottawa view things, the way in which the current government views things. And you've seen and you've probably heard over the years about Stephen Harper and his call for a firewall to be built around Alberta. Well, when he came to power, he actually built a firewall around the tar sands. There has been a great deal of protection of the tar sands. Whenever you see the discussion of policy and development of policy on greenhouse gas emissions or the development of energy policies in general, the tar sands ends up being protected. And it's extremely important that we understand that and to understand that insofar as there is any consideration of the fundamentals being in place in the Canadian economy, that is not the case. It is a distorted set of fundamentals and subject to a great deal of vulnerability. Now let's look on the environment crisis and again the way in which the tar sands plays a role in creating and expanding the environmental crisis that we are faced with. It has been known, the tar sands has been labeled and known as the most environmentally destructive project on the earth. And the fact is the tar sands does trigger a great deal of our own environmental woes and the crises that we are now confronting. First of all, it is the largest global warming machine to be found in this country. We say that because the tar sands generates 3 to 5 times the amount of greenhouse gases as is generated by the oil industry, the conventional oil industry itself. 3 to 5 times more. As a result, the tar sands has become Canada's number one greenhouse gas emitter. And the reason for this is that the current government still looks upon its remedy for greenhouse gases in terms of intensity. That is to say, we will reduce the amount of greenhouse gases per product produced. The problem is that with the tar sands, there's going to be exponential growth over the next 15 and 20 years. And so no matter what you do with the tar sands, as long as you stick with a policy of intensity, all you do is affect how much greenhouse gases are maybe produced as a result of each barrel of oil, and do not look at the fact there are going to be multiple millions of barrels of oil produced over a period of time. And the growth track itself means a huge increase in greenhouse gas emissions from the tar sands. If you look at the next chart here, you will see this escalation that I'm talking about. In 2008, 68 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions will have been generated by the end of the year in greenhouse gas emissions from the tar sands. But if you look ahead to 2012, that number goes from 68 to 132 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. And then by 2015, 164 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. So you see this escalation that goes on because the industry is multiplying its output two, three, four, and five times. Over the next 8 years, the production is supposed to multiply something like between 4 and 5 times what it is at the present time. That is the kind of growth that's taking place, and as a result, the kind of growth in greenhouse gas emissions itself. But it's more than that. We have to realize that the boreal forests, which are really the carbon sink of the planet, they absorb carbon, are being ripped apart by the building and of the tar sands itself. The strip mining that is taking place, and when you look at the whole area itself, something like 90,000 square miles of boreal forests are in danger of being strip mined. This is the size of the Maritime Provinces taken together, or Florida. And as a result, what you end up with is a moonscape instead of a forest. What is really important here, however, though, is how the tar sands development and that strip mining is ripping apart nature's own way of dealing with carbon emissions. And as the end result is that we find ourselves generating more greenhouse gas emissions and at the same time ripping apart nature's way of dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. But the issue goes deeper. And Brian, yes, we will be talking about water tonight. And it is largely in terms of the depletion of water sources in that area. We are dealing here with the Athabasca watershed, which links to the Mackenzie Delta watershed and also to the North Saskatchewan watershed. And that whole area is designated and considered to be one of the most precious watersheds in the entire globe itself. And yet, through the tar sands production, something like between 2 and 4.5 to 5 barrels of water are required to produce 1 barrel of oil. And that's largely from the differences between the in-situ process, which uses a great deal more water than the strip mining itself. So a great deal of water is lost in the process. And one of the great water scientists of this country, David Schindler, who is from Alberta, has been giving off warning signs for the last 5 or 6 years, saying we are in deep trouble, the prairies are going back into drought period, and the tar sands has contributed to major water depletion in the area. But it's more than that, too. It's also because of the way in which water contamination is affecting both people's lives and the wildlife in this area. Downstream from the tar sands at a place called Fort Chipewyan, the fish are deformed, as you see in that right-hand photo. The moose find that their arsenic rate is 453 times what it is supposed to be, or what the normal rate would be. What's happening is that over here you see these toxic ponds, which are full of toxic chemicals. And these toxic ponds seep the toxic chemicals into the groundwater systems that in turn affect the Athabasca River system, which in turn affect the people and the wildlife downstream. And the cancer rates in a place like Fort Chipewyan have been astronomical as a result of what has been happening. So, and the people who inhabit these areas are the First Nations, are the Aboriginal peoples of this part of the country. So there is a great deal of triggering of an environment crisis that's going on as far as the tar sands is concerned.